Another aspect that always affects the outcome of negotiations is information. How much information does one side have about the other side? Almost always, the side that has the most information about the other side can do better in the negotiations. Information is so critical in so many areas of negotiations. Whichever way we go in our discussion of negotiations, we come back to the importance of getting information about the other side. In session one, we talked about it being the key to win-win negotiations. Find out what the other person really wants and see if you can give it to them. In session two, we talked about it being the second stage of negotiations. When you're involved in any conflict or negotiation, take the time to find out as much as you can about the other side. And in session seven, we saw that it's one of the key elements in power. Here we'll discuss the fact that the side that has the most information usually can control the negotiations. Companies spend millions of dollars checking out other companies before they'll go into merger talks, don't they? Even in England, as I was growing up, I knew that Macy's and Gimbel's were each other's biggest customer, that Macy's bought more of Gimbel's merchandise than anybody else, and Gimbel's bought more of Macy's because they needed to know about the competition. They were willing to spend the money to do it. Governments spend billions of dollars before they'll go into an arms control talk, finding out about the other side. It was interesting to me to see Henry Kissinger being interviewed prior to the Geneva talks with the Russians. He was not a negotiator in these talks, but he was being asked for some background information. Mr. Kissinger, the interviewer, said, "Do you think it's possible that our negotiators know what the Russians will propose before they actually propose it?" He said, "Absolutely. No question about it." He said it would be absolutely disastrous for us to go into a negotiation not knowing in advance what the other side was going to propose. Can you imagine the cost of getting that kind of information, and yet it's so essential to good negotiations? So if companies will spend that kind of money, and governments think it's important enough to spend that kind of money, doesn't it make sense that we at least spend a little time before we go into negotiations finding out more about the other side? Now think about what was probably your largest investment, the home in which you live. Before you made the first offer to buy it, how much did you know about the owners of the home? How much did you know about their real needs, their real intentions in the negotiation? And very often, even the listing agent doesn't know, do they? The person who's been in direct contact with the sellers when they listed the property, when asked what the objectives of the sellers are, will very often say, "Well, I don't know. I know they want cash out. They're not willing to carry back paper, but I don't know what they're going to do with the cash. I didn't think it was my place to ask." How about the automobile, which may well have been your second largest investment? How much did you know about the real needs and objectives of that dealership before you bought your automobile? Knowledge is power. Why are we so concerned about getting the knowledge that we want? Most of us are so scared of rejection, which is coercive power, that we won't even ask. And we really only have to ask, but we have to understand the importance of asking and take the time to do it. Rudyard Kipling talked about his five honest serving men. He said, "They've taught me all I know. They're who, what, when, where, and why." Learn to use those words to find out what you need to know. Learn the art of probing. Learn how to ask open-ended questions. Closed-ended questions are questions that can be answered with a yes or a no or a specific answer. For example, "How old are you?" is a closed-end question. You'll get a number and that's it. "How do you feel about being the age that you are?" is an open-ended question. It invites more than just a yes or a no or a specific answer response. Here are some techniques that you can use to get information. First of all, try repeating the question. They say, "We discontinued that line," but they don't explain why, and you want to know why. You repeat the question. "You discontinued that line?" Very often they'll come back with a complete explanation of why they did. Ask for feelings, not what happened, but how did you feel about what happened? "How did you feel about that?" you say. It invites an open response. Ask for responses. "How did you react to that?" rather than "what happened then." Ask for restatement. "I don't understand why you did that." Chances are, instead of repeating the same words, they'll come back with a more detailed explanation of what happened. It's so easy to get information, it's hard to believe that we're so reluctant. As president of the real estate company in California, I wanted to encourage our agents to knock on doors, searching for leads. Real estate people call it farming. And yet I found them very, very reluctant to do it. So I eventually formulated a plan where I would take each one of our 28 office managers out separately, knocking on doors. And we would play the information game. I would say, okay, I'm going to knock on the first door, and I'm going to see how much information I can get from these people. You knock on the second door, see if you can get more information than I did. And it was amazing to see the amount of information that people would volunteer to a stranger on their doorstep. I could get them to tell me where they worked, where their wife worked, sometimes how much money they make, how long they'd been in the property, how much they paid for it, how much their loan payments were, and so on. People are very often very anxious to volunteer information if we'll only ask. Apart from directly asking the person with whom you've been negotiating, how else can you gather information about the other side? Well, one thing, of course, you can do is ask people who've done business with this company themselves. I think you'd be amazed, even if you thought of them as competition, how much they'd be willing to share with you, what they've learned in their dealings with that company. Another way is to ask people further down the corporate ladder than the person you plan to deal with. Let's say you're going to be negotiating with someone at the main office. You might call up one of the branch offices. If possible, get an appointment to stop by and see the branch manager and do some preliminary negotiating with that person. He'll tell you a lot, even though he can't actually negotiate the deal, about how the company buys, why they buy, the factors that they take into consideration, the profit margins they expect, the quantities they normally buy, and so on and so forth. Another way to do it is when you go to the company, take someone from your company who's a professional person, such as a mechanic, an engineer, or an appraiser. Someone whose loyalties stretch beyond the corporation and, in actual fact, lead into their profession itself. You can take an engineer from your company with you to visit another company that you plan on doing business with and let your engineer mix with the other engineers. You'll find out that, unlike top management, the level at which you may be negotiating, engineers have a common bond that spreads throughout their profession, rather than just a vertical loyalty to the company for which they currently work. So all kinds of information will be spread between these two. Now, what you've got to watch out for, of course, is that your man doesn't give away information that could be damaging to you. So be sure you pick the right person, caution him carefully what you're willing to tell and what you're not willing to tell, the difference between your open agenda and your hidden agenda, and let him go to it trying to gather information. It's very, very effective. The location where you do the asking can make a big difference also. If you meet with someone at their corporate headquarters surrounded by their trappings of power and authority and their formality of doing business, it's the least likely place for you to get information. If you meet over lunch one day when the formality is down, you're much more liable to get information from that person. However, if you meet for lunch at your country club surrounded by your trappings of power and authority, where he's obligated to you because you're buying the lunch, then you're much more likely to get information. There's no question that information is power. If you're thinking of acquiring a new piece of equipment for your company, you should no more buy from the first salesperson than you should marry the first woman that comes along. Shop around and find out what's available before you make a decision. Call up companies, have all their salespeople come in, and make a presentation to you. You'll find that one has a good point in one particular area, maybe a fast shipment, another has a low price, another has a good guarantee. So you piece together from all these interviews the ideal piece of equipment, and then you go back to the one you like best and say, I'd like to buy your equipment, except that I want to get the longer guarantee, or I want to get the faster shipping. By cherry-picking, you create the type of merchandise, the kind of contract that you want. Now, if you're a salesperson and that type of operation is so frustrating to you, you're trying to sell something and you know that the buyer is going to talk to all the other salespeople in town, how do you forestall it? Well, know more about your competition than he'll ever learn. So that when he says, well, I want to check with some other people before I make my final decision, you say, I absolutely agree with you. Always agree up front, right? Salesperson always agrees with any objection, however ridiculous it is. I agree with you absolutely. You should check with other companies before you make a decision. But look, let me save you some time. If you talk to Ted Smith over at ABC Company, he has his model number 12345, which has this feature, this feature, and this feature. But he doesn't have this. Then if you talk to the national company over here, the salesperson who come out will be Fred Harrison. and he'll tell you about model number such and such. And by the time you've gone through your entire presentation of letting him know how much you know about his competition, he's going to say, well, why on earth do I need to waste my time talking to all these other people when this man knows more than I'll ever learn? Remember, then, that the gathering of information is the second step in any negotiating process, and it should never be overlooked. The first step is establishing criteria, the open agenda, and the hidden agenda. The second step is gathering information, and the third step is reaching for goal compromises that will achieve momentum to reach a settlement. I think of the information gathering process as rather like the game of battleship that I used to play when I was a youngster in England. When I was growing up in England after World War II, there were no toys being manufactured. We had to entertain ourselves with little games that we could create without having to buy anything. And this was the game of battleship. We would sit at a table across from each other and build a barrier in between us so that we couldn't see the piece of paper that was in front of the other person. The barrier was maybe constructed from a pile of books. We would take a piece of paper in front of us and draw in a large number of squares, maybe 100 different squares marked with the alphabet down one side and numbers along the bottom. Onto this graph, we would draw our fleet of battleships and cruisers and destroyers and so on. The other person, of course, wouldn't know where we'd located them. They would attempt to bomb them by calling out the graph number. The parallel here is that the hidden piece of paper in negotiations is the other person's hidden agenda. By judicious questioning, you should try and find out as much as you possibly can of that person's hidden agenda and recreate it on your side so that you know exactly where he's coming from and what he's trying to achieve. The third element that's always critical in negotiations is time. The person under the most time pressure usually does worse in the negotiations. There's a Pareto principle that applies here. Pareto was a 19th century Italian economist who was the first person to point out that 80% of the wealth of Italy was in the hands of 20% of the people. And that 80-20 rule seems to work in a lot of other areas, too. Sales managers will tell me that 80% of their business is typically done by 20% of their salespeople. School teachers will tell me that 80% of the trouble is caused by 20% of the kids. The rule in negotiating is that 80% of the concessions come down in the last 20% of the time available to negotiate. Think of the last time that you bought a piece of real estate. Maybe it was your home. It possibly took 10 weeks from the time you signed the initial contract to the time you actually became the owner of the property. Now think of the concessions that were made. Isn't it true that during that last 2 weeks, when things come up to be renegotiated, that both sides become more flexible? Some people are unethical enough to use this against you. Elements of the negotiation that could be brought up earlier and resolved are held until the last minute. When you're getting ready to finalize the arrangements, then these problems come up, because they know you'll be more flexible under time pressure. What this tells you is tie up all the details up front. Don't leave anything to, oh, we can work that out later. I remember being in Kalispell, Montana one time to do a seminar for the GRI, the Graduate Realtors Institute of the state of Montana. These are the highest trained real estate people in the state. We were doing an all-day seminar on negotiating. And during the break, a lady agent came up to me and said, can you help me? I'm about to lose most of my commission on a very large transaction. She said, several months ago, this man came into my office and wanted me to list his $600,000 home. Well, we don't have too many $600,000 homes in Montana, and I guess I was a little intimidated by that, because when he asked me how much commission I would charge to do that, he flinched and I fell for it. He asked me how much commission. I said, well, 6%. And he said, 6%? That's $36,000. And I said, well, look, if you have to come down much on the price of the property, we'll work with you on the commission. That's all I said, and I never gave it a second thought. Well, as luck would have it, I double whammied the transaction. I found the buyer also. So now I have the full 6% commission coming into my office. He didn't have to come down very much on the price, and the property is due to close next week. Yesterday, he came into my office and said, look, I've been thinking about the amount of work that you had to do on that property. Now, remember, the value of services always appears to diminish rapidly after those services have been performed. And you remember you told me that you would work with me on the commission? She said, yes. He said, well, I've been thinking about the amount of work you did, and I've decided that $5,000 would be a very fair commission for you. $5,000 when she was due, $36,000. She was almost panic-stricken. But it's a good illustration that you shouldn't leave anything to, we can work that out later. because a little detail up front can become a big problem later on when you're under time pressure. That story is also an interesting illustration of how we always think we have the weaker hand in the negotiations, whichever side we're on. In actual fact, she was in a very strong position, wasn't she? As I explained to her, she had a written contract for the 6%. If anything, it was verbally modified by a very vague comment that probably wouldn't hold up in court anyway. So she was in a position to put a Liz Pendens, a lawsuit pending on the property, stopping the property from being sold until she had resolved the commission issue. So in actual fact, she was in a very strong position, but didn't think she was. When do your children ask you for something? Just as you're rushing out of the door, right? When Julia was attending USC in Southern California, she lived in a sorority house and she would come home for the weekends. She'd need money for books. When would she ask me? 7 o'clock on a Monday morning, just as she was racing out the door, she'll say, "Dad, I'm sorry, I forgot. I need $60 for books." I say, "Julia, don't do this to me. I teach this stuff. Now, how come you've been home all weekend? How come we didn't have a chance to talk about it before?" "Well, sorry, Dad, I just didn't think about it until I got ready to go, but look, I'm late now. I've got to get on the freeway. I'll be late for class, and if I can't get my books today, I won't be able to take my finals on Wednesday, so please, can I have the money now, and we'll talk next weekend?" Not that the children are that manipulative, but instinctively, over all those years of dealing with me, they understand that under time pressure, people become more flexible. Interesting, again, to look at some of the international negotiations and how time is related there. The story that's always told is the Paris-Vietnam peace talks. You'll recall that in the spring of 1968, Lyndon Johnson had announced that he would not run for re-election and would devote all his time to trying to get the peace talks resolved. And he was very anxious to do something before the November elections when his friend Hubert Humphrey would be running for election. He sent our negotiator, Averill Harriman, to Paris with clear instructions. Get something done, get it done fast, right now, Texas style. Well, Averill Harriman got to Paris, checked into the Ritz Hotel, and rented a suite on a week-to-week basis. The Vietnamese negotiators got to Paris and rented a villa in the countryside for 2.5 years. Then they proceeded to spend week after week after week talking to us about the shape of the table. Now, did they really care about the shape of the table? Of course they didn't. They were trying to do two things. Number one, they were trying to project to us that they were in no hurry whatsoever. Another year or two here or there wouldn't make any difference to them. And secondly, they were trying to push us up against our deadline of the November elections, which they did very, very successfully. If you'll recall the Humphrey-Nixon election, on the Sunday, 2 days before Election Day, they were announcing a breakthrough in Paris. When you negotiate that close to a deadline, you are very, very vulnerable. Another international negotiation where time played a big part was the Falkland Island crisis. You'll recall that at that time, Alexander Haig was our Secretary of State. And it was a very unusual war because we had 2 weeks' advance notice of what was going to happen. As the British fleet sailed down the Atlantic to recapture the islands, we actually had 2 weeks' notice. Now, nobody ever thought we'd have that kind of notice in a war again, but there it was, a brilliant opportunity to display virtuoso negotiating skills. But Alexander Haig didn't use time to his advantage. Instead of letting time pressure build up, he immediately started a showboat type of shuttle diplomacy, flying from London to Buenos Aires to Washington back and forth all the time, trying to get a ceasefire arranged. He probably would have done better to wait until the British Navy was closer to the Falkland Islands when time pressure was at its greatest, and then step in. He would have stood much more chance of getting something done. So when you're negotiating with people, never reveal that you have a deadline. Let's say, for example, that you have flown to a particular city to resolve negotiating a particular contract, and you have a flight to leave that city at 6 o'clock. You're anxious to catch that flight, but don't let the other people know. You may reveal that you have a 6 o'clock flight, but you also have a 9 o'clock backup flight, or for that matter, you can stay over for as long as it takes to work out a mutually satisfactory arrangement. Because if they know you're under time pressure, you'll find that the bulk of the negotiations will be done at the last possible minute. And there's a real danger there that you'll give things away under time pressure. So, we've looked at three elements here that are really critical to negotiations. In session 7, we talked about power and influence and how it affects the negotiations. In this session, we've talked about the other two elements, Information, the person with more of it tends to do better. And time, the person with less of it tends to do worse. In sessions 9 and 10, we'll talk about another critical element in the negotiation process, and that's personality styles. So important to understand that you have a particular personality style. The people with whom you'll be negotiating do also. And when the two don't match, you have problems. We'll also show you how negotiating styles negotiate differently.
This is the end of Side 8. Side 7 is already queued up for your listening.